You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with David Bordet. David, thanks so much for being with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
David, we're going to talk about your work and I guess start with a piece at Helen and Rather Gallery on Bowery. And it was a really interesting show there, and you just graduated Yale, correct? The MFA program this
yeah.
June, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so let's talk about, I want to talk about this and also some of the work from that show. But yeah, let's talk about Wildcard. This was a sculpture that you and your friend Tommy Coleman made, correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so Tommy is somebody that I've been friends with for quite a few years now. I think, as often happens in life, he was quite skeptical just of me as a person when we first met, and then we became best friends essentially. So we had made this work together for an exhibition with a curator that we both know who is a longtime baseball fan, and he had for a long time been imagining doing an exhibition that kind of explored some of the intersections between both artistic practice and baseball as part of the wider pop cultural zeitgeist. So, you know, this work was in that exhibition along with, like, you know, some Raymond Pettibon drawings and stuff of this nature. And we were, I think, as many people are, even that don't have any particular interest in baseball, drawn to the famous story of Doc Ellis and the LSD no-no, the no-hitter that he pitched in the 1970s.
And what is that? What is that? I don't know enough about baseball to know about the relationship between LSD and Doc Ellis.
Sure. I mean, this is kind of one of the, like, wildest stories in the pantheon of, like, baseball as a cultural force. But Doc Ellis was a fresh player, I think, in his second year in 1971, playing for the Pittsburgh Pirates. And he was originally from L.A., but had been out in Pittsburgh pitching. And they had a, I don't know if it was a 2 or 3 game series against the San Diego Padres on the schedule, and had gotten permission to go back to Southern California a couple days in advance of the game. And when he got there, went to a friend's house, and they decided they were going to party a bit and took LSD. And flash forward a couple days later, having lost track of time and doubled down several further times on their dosage of LSD, Doc made it just on time to the ballpark and pitched a no-hitter, which, you know, if you're a pitcher in baseball, this is like the greatest of all achievements, when he was, in his telling, as high as a Georgia Pine. and this
he
was
tripping, though. I mean, he's not, that's what you're talking about, like on acid, high on acid.
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, there's a great interview with him where he talks about how everybody knew that he was high on something, but just didn't know what it was, because especially at that time, there were a lot of guys on, you know, amphetamines and other stuff under the guise of being performance enhancing. And he accidentally ended up on LSD, having lost track of time and the volume that he initially took. I mean, it's a really crazy story, and it's sad in a way, because when this eventually came out, he was banned from the Baseball Hall of Fame, which has this kind of remarkable irony considering how many other people with, you know, no hesitation as far as taking substances as part of their, you know, practice as athletes, being in the Hall of Fame. And but he eventually, you know, came to peace with that, and you know, I think Tommy and I were interested in how he's a figure that occupies a Hall of Fame status all his own. So,
but meanwhile,
yeah.
Like LSD isn't really a performance enhancing drug, or
that's
not
right.
Fun of that way, right? I mean, that's the really odd thing. It's like, you know, you lose, you took the drug. I mean, usually that, you'd think that would make you incapable of playing the game completely.
Yeah. Yeah, and as I understand,
like maybe you'd be looking at the baseball for 2 minutes instead of playing the game when, you know, something like that, right?
Oh, no, exactly. I mean, you're exactly right. And you know, in numerous interviews that he's done, he would talk about how he would look in his glove at the ball sometimes, and sometimes it would be really tiny, sometimes it would be huge. There was this kind of like fog and mist that was blowing in from the ocean, and like that made it really, really crazy for him to pitch. I mean, just all of the sort of sensory kaleidoscopic milieu that one might encounter in that state, but then having to perform at such a high level. Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible story, and I think as a bit of lore, I've recently found myself kind of like that word seems to be more apt at getting at the heart of a lot of my interests. The kind of the lore.
So, yeah. How so? I mean, talking about, I've seen your studio at Yale, and of course there's links to your website, so listeners can go through more. But how does that work? This wild card that is has the Doc Ellis baseball card and the LSD. How does that relate to your other work?
I think that like what I'm interested in is like kind of the role of fantasy or of like narrative form in like identity and in history, and the way that certain like myths or kind of like unverifiable information becomes like the hook on which we hang certain ideas of ourselves. And then in the role of like authenticity or kind of the way that like media and narrative becomes more real than facts themselves. And so like, I don't know that anybody would question this story. It's a pretty well cemented facet of baseball history at this point, but to me this becomes a microcosm through which like sport and race and culture and, you know, all of these forces that are themselves prominent parts of like the American, you know, identity can reveal something of ourselves to ourselves. Does that make any sense?
It doesn't make sense. So to talk about that married with also your, because that's almost like the narrative, right, or the subtext of this approach. Then when, you know, I've seen your studio and what you had at Yale there, and one of the things that struck me, I mean, just to talk about materials, is the enormous amount of like stuff you had in your studio. Not that most sculpture studios don't have stuff in it, but you had like the body of a Carmen Ghia in there. You had enormous letters on the wall that said Stardust. That just looks like it was a feat just to get that material into your room. You know, almost like the moving of the sheer weight of this, you know, was part of this process. I mean, that's one of the things that struck me when I was in there was, wow, the scale of it, but also like, this is very kind of ambitious to drag all these materials in here. How does that go, you know, kind of connect with what you're saying, your kind of narrative or your approach, because that's not uncommon, right? I mean, there was a number of materials in there of all kinds and different objects, but there was also enormous, enormous objects in there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I have driven and traveled, like across the country, not like mostly in my little blue Toyota Tacoma, like 1999, it's approaching like 350,000 miles on the odometer. And I found myself, as I traveled, kind of like moved or enchanted with like roadside signage or of like the traces of things physically speaking that then would connect to these other larger histories. And so I have always found myself kind of with a particular sensitivity to materials. So for example, with the baseball card, that is actually like LSD blotter paper. And as part of the work, we, Tommy and myself, hand perforated the card into little 1 by 1 centimeter blocks that then were washed in liquid LSD. And the card is trapped between two pieces of UV shatterproof museum acrylic. So you know, like, but the unverifiability of that, unless I were to pass it out, is itself part of the sort of alchemy of materials that I'm interested in. And like, you know, do you believe it? Do you not? Does it matter if it's real? And so like, that's just one example of like how my sensitivity to materials works. And I mean, or I'll give you another quick example. As I've been moving out of my studio, which as you might imagine was a pretty heroic effort.
Yeah, exactly.
I found kind of these little pieces of a meteorite that I had bought a kilogram of a Campo del Cielo meteorite, which is found primarily in Argentina and is believed to be like 4,000 or 5,000 years old. And I had originally purchased the material to include in an iron pour that we were doing. And I made a plaque for another project that is like embedded within the walls of the sculpture building at Yale now. And so I came across some of these little nuggets left over from the meteorite and ended up making, as I was exiting, bootleg Stardust Resort and Casino matchbooks that I gave to a few people with a magnet that would both hold it onto any surface that was metal and then also allow the little piece of meteorite to kind of hover vertically on the surface of the matchbook once it was placed. And it's these little moments of, I don't know, enchantment or wonder or spectacle that I found myself moved by. And I think a lot of that comes from like working on film in television sets, which is something that I had done for quite a few years prior to coming to school and kind of finding myself just as, if not more, taken or enchanted with some of these huge, sometimes cavernous sets, kind of knowing the artificiality of things made it even more powerful to kind of know that on the other side, it was all just like 1 by 3 lumber from, you know, Home Depot or plaster and stuff that could move me in this way. And so I've kind of increasingly invested myself in kind of like things that are unverifiable or impossible to prove, like unless you want to go looking for this cast plaque in the sculpture building, which the poor facilities manager would probably, you know, have a nervous breakdown if somebody did. Sure. Go looking for that, you know, it's both participating in and generating lore and kind of like micro myth in some way. Yeah.
Right. So that's so interesting. And let's talk about one more piece in there that I like, because it also seemed a little bit different than all the rest. But The Endless Ride, part of your thesis, cowboy hat, it looks like, with candles on it, covered in wax. This mm-hmm. was the first piece in the show. I mean, in your studio that I saw that really kind of made me smile, had a sense of humor to it. There was something very different about this, same approach to materials, but also I found a different kind of sense of humor in that. Or how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I also think that there's a lot of humor.
Or is it performative? It also seemed like a performative, and like this is left over from a performance. It had that feeling too, like I missed the show kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like specifically with that work, it was not part of a performance, but I like the performativity of objects or of kind of encountering something in a way that it's not clear if you have arrived shortly before something is going to happen or during an intermission or you missed it altogether. And yeah, I mean, sense of humor is something that's definitely important to me, and that I think there's kind of a reverence or a seriousness that so much of art is approached with, that I think is largely good and correct. But I am both, I want to believe that I can both be earnestly moved by something and acknowledge the absurdity in it, you know?
Right.
And so the cowboy hat, yeah, it's kind of ridiculous. You know, talking about lore, I had been reading a book about Billy the Kid, who died at the raw age of 21 and was, you know, already a legend in his own time, and who, like, despite living so briefly, looms so large, and so much of his life is unverifiable. He became kind of a folk hero to some of the indigenous population, and despite the fact that, you know, what few documents that exist suggest that he was, you know, pretty much exclusively Irish in heritage, and may have lived like in New York in housing tenements like early in his life with his mother. Anyway, I don't know. I'm interested in the messiness of it all and the impossibility of being able to square that circle. And like, I'd like to think that the work is an invitation to like relish in all of it, like the beauty, the humor, the horror, you know, to reduce it to any one of these things is to not encounter it in its like full kaleidoscopic quality, you know?
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And so what'll happen now is, and we're talking in July in 2023 or post school, post and rather, what's happening in your studio that you're involved in at the moment? Is it anything specific? Are you working towards a project or anything in particular on your own practice?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So literally the entire studio, with the exception of like a few like kind of tools that I take with me just about anywhere I go, to like fix a leaky faucet at the house or whatever, are everything, including the 30-foot wide Stardust sign, the Carmen Ghia, you know, all my equipment is in a 40-foot shipping container in Orange, Connecticut presently. And I have found gainful employment in New York that I begin later this month, and I will be kind of settling in to the city, which is where I was prior to March 2020, when I think everybody kind of collectively realized, if they hadn't already, that you know, everything was about to change. So that's exciting. It's scary. But I do have a few things coming up that I can share and I'm excited about. One is that I have generously been included in an exhibition that doesn't have a nailed down opening date quite yet, but will happen probably later July at a new space called International Objects that's in Brooklyn, kind of East Williamsburg. It's a space that is new and being done by these people that had a former curatorial outfit called International Waters, which had done a lot of interesting things in the same area. And then I'm talking with a friend of mine who also has a space in East Williamsburg about possibly putting the Stardust work on the roof of his building for some period of time, and we're figuring out some of the insane logistics of what that would look like, but we're hoping we might be able to pull that off in late autumn. Yeah.
Oh, good. That's exciting. And so do you have a studio in Manhattan now, or in Orange, or?
So I'm between places. I know where I'll be moving into. I'll have a studio also in East Williamsburg as part of this complex that a lot of artists have moved into the prior years. And I'm going to be moving back into the spot I was in prior to coming to school, which will kind of bookend things nicely. But I'm always excited to speak with people that are excited about what I'm doing. As you can imagine, like making stuff that is kind of a scale that it's inconvenient to exhibit or share often. I'm always interested in kind of like people reaching out. If you'd like to come and visit, I would encourage anybody to communicate with me. It's nice to have people stop by. So I would think by late August, I will be settled into the studio and probably ramping up production on some new things. Yeah.
Oh, that's great to hear, you know, and, you know, I like the way you put that also, because that's, I guess, partly why I asked about the studio. By creating exhibits, creating works that are very difficult to move, that are difficult to install, that are difficult to collect, really, requires a special setup for a studio arrangement, right?
Because
you just can't put everything in one space unless you have a cavernous space, which is also possible, but a little harder in Brooklyn somewhere, and right?
Yeah. I mean, I assume it's possible. It's certainly without, you know, outside of my means or abilities. So many of these spaces have been gobbled up, and I've been fortunate enough to get to know, like, a handful of artists of an older generation who have told me their version of the story of, like, oh, I bought my Soho loft in the 70s for, you know, like $60,000, or, you know, somebody who had to, like, beg their father for the last $2,000 to buy an apartment in what he described as, like, a, you know, a dead-end neighborhood that we now call Tribeca. You know, so it's harder now perhaps than it has ever been, but you know, I get excited by these challenges, and I think in all likelihood I will continue to rent my 40-foot shipping container in Orange, and that's will kind of be the deeper storage. But I don't know. I mean, if I let kind of logistical hurdles prevent me from doing things, then a lot of the most exciting stuff would never happen. So I don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one more question before we go, which is, what are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious what everyone's reading.
Yeah. I'm actually reading a book that I had been given quite some time ago by my friend Tommy, called The Shape of Time. And it's by a gentleman who, I guess, put it out through one of Yale's publishing houses, I believe in the 70s. I think I've got it here. Yeah. It's the author's name is George Kubler, called The Shape of Time, and it's about like the relationship of objects and materials to the history of, like, what it means to be human. It's kind of a alternative venture through kind of, you know, a refusal of the more typical anthropological frameworks that we look at the objects that humans make, like tools and stuff, and it kind of proposes that art and creative pursuit is as essential to understanding who we are as anything else. And so I think Tommy will be quite pleased to know that I'm finally reading this book that he gave me such a long time ago.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. And I want to thank you for the show and talking to me today. There's links in here so people can look at your website and reach out and see the work that we've been discussing. So, again, I just want to thank you so much, David, for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure. I wish you well this summer and this year.
Thank you so much. It's been a privilege speaking with you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.